Good. Can everybody hear me fine? I promised to be like a box of chocolates. You don't know what you're going to get. I'll have both positive and negative for you as we go. So that may not be exactly what you want, John, but I won't be Dr. Bear for 30 minutes. I might be for at least 10. My last slide I show you is I'm going to show you where these slides you can find on the web. You guys know this by now. I usually don't bring a hard copy handout. I'm not against saving trees, but that's not my motive. The motive is I actually want you to have to go get them because they get updated over time. So a certain amount of what I'm going to share with you, the core story might hold, but precise prices and so forth, of course, you know, they were out of date when I left campus, right, to some degree. So you need to monitor and go and update yourself. And I encourage you to use our Ag Manager website to do that. So I will show you exactly how to do that at the end. But the other reason I tell you that up front is you're welcome to write down any price. You have the right to hold that against me if you want. But I'm more interested in getting the story across to you. So take as many notes as you want, but you'll get the slides at the end. So that is a broad intro. Most of you also know I like to start, I joke saying, I think I can explain almost anything in the world by understanding the supply fundamentals and demand fundamentals, except maybe marriage. But even there, I bet you I could give you some interesting supply and demand points that would make you chuckle. The reason I tell you that is I'm what you might call a free market economist. I think I can explain prices and quantities that we see going through the industry when I back up and understand where we're at with supplies, where we think we're going to be with supplies, where we're at with demand, where we think we're going to be at with demand. So I'm going to do that true to form here today. Now, when you start on the supply perspective, most of us know we are still, from a historic perspective, at low beef supplies on a per-person basis. So I have per capita right there in parentheses. And what I mean by that is we still have a relatively small calf crop. The U.S. population continues to grow, so the amount of beef available per person is lower than it used to be. But that part is changing, right? We pulled the trigger on herd expansion. I'm going to tell you about 10 different ways. I think we're not done with that. We're going to expand quite a bit as long as it keeps raining. And if we do that, we're going to have more and more beef in the system per person. But it's important to keep in mind for the last at least 5 years, from a long-term perspective, we've had tight supplies that have been supportive of prices. And anybody's heard me, I've been saying that for quite a while. That is still the case in aggregate, but it's a little bit old news. We've pulled the trigger on expansion, so we're past the tipping point on the tight supply story. Okay? So both long-term context on that as well as where we're going is important to keep in mind throughout this whole discussion. On the demand side of things, beef demand in the U.S. has been very positive since 2010. And my last half dozen slides are specific to demand, and that's where I'm going to end our talk. But it's very important to keep in mind that, and I was picking on 2014, for example, how many of you are cow-calf producers, or at least have a cow-calf segment to your operation? Okay? Raise your hand if you liked returns in 2014. Okay. Now, if you raised your hand first time but not the second, you need to go home and have a serious discussion about whether you know your books and what you're doing, okay? Because anybody that had an animal to sell probably made more in 2014 than they've ever made before. They're usually going to ask that. But the reason I give you that is that happened for two reasons. One is we had very few animals in the supply chain, but we also had very strong demand for beef products, both of which pull retail beef prices up, wholesale beef prices up, all the way down to Kansas calf prices up, okay? And you can't lose sight of that. Both those factors have been very supportive for beef prices. Going forward, and we're already there in the first quarter of 16, the supply side is not going to be as supportive because we're adding more pounds in the system. It's going to become even more important to monitor where we're at with beef demand strength. Okay? It's always important, but it's going to become obvious when we don't have the supply support, whether or not we have strong demand or not. That will mitigate just how bearish we are on prices. Okay? I apologize for this cutting off at the top, but you guys can still get the general point. I like to open up with a few numbers, just give you the general trajectories of where things are going. This is information from LMIC. It's a group called Livestock Marketing Information Center out in Denver. K-State and a lot of other universities basically pay to be a member of that. They pull together lots of USDA data so that I don't have to every day, synthesize it, kick it back out for me to use so I can kind of tell you the story. One of the things they do is put out projections basically for the next 2 years. So what is up here is, just for context across the top, is 2015 by quarter, and then the first yellow row is the year 2015. In the middle is 2016, and the bottom is 2017, again by quarter, and then by year. I want to highlight the purple arrows. I say this even if an administrator isn't here, but with Ernie here, I have to say, I'm proud to have a W-2 from K-State, that's why there's a lot of purple arrows up here. But the arrows tell the story. We've pulled the trigger on expansion. Commercial slaughter is going up, to the tune that for 2016, we think we're going to slaughter 3.3% more animals than we did in 2015. And when you go further out to 2017, for you guys, those of you who got real good eyesight, it's a 4% increase further yet. So you pull the trigger, you have more calves, we're going to slaughter more animals, right? That's basically the story there. In the middle, we have dress weight, which are also projected, with the exception of the fourth quarter, to be higher year over year. And the only reason they're not projected to be higher in the fourth quarter of 16 is because they were so big in the fourth quarter of 2015. So a year over year since, we have a small decline. But if you have more animals in the system and more pounds per animal, you have more commercial beef production. That's why the arrow on the far right, okay? So we're putting more beef into the system. That's all the quantity side of this story. What does that do to prices? This slide right here has fed cattle 5 market average, followed by 7 to 8 weight yearling prices for Southern Plains and 5 to 6 calves. Down, 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 okay? This is the same setup in Alex prices. Let's start from the far right, give you the calf price story. For the fourth quarter of 2016, LMIC is putting out a price quote basically between 189 and 198. So near but sub $2. That would be probably $15 over what the market futures market suggests now. So if I was to put solely a futures market forecast up here, John, you would take these numbers that are already quite a bit lower than last year and knock another $10 to $20 off of them, depending on exactly which month and basis rules you use. The same kind of holds for yearlings. When you go over here to fed cattle, year-over-year declines are being projected for 2016, again, until we get to the fourth quarter, which is projected to be 3% higher than last year. But this is another example where year-over-year changes can be misleading. Most of you probably remember how low fed cattle prices got in the fourth quarter of 2015. So a low number then compared to a still low but slightly higher number gives you a small increase for 2016 on fed cattle price. The trajectory for 2017 is very similar. Okay, so to avoid boring you with numbers, if you have a sub $2 calf price, by historic standards, that's still real good. But it's nowhere near what 2014 was, right? So this is our glass half full, glass half empty kind of person, right? I'm going to show you in a minute, I think an average cost producer is still set up to make money in the next couple of years for cow-calf, but nowhere near like we did in 2014. That's what this chart is, okay? So now I'm going to walk you through the entire industry, starting cow-calf, work my way to the consumer. This is a chart that goes back to 1987, comes out to 2015, and then the last bar is a projected number for 2016. And this is returns over cash cost for a Southern Plains representative cow-calf operation. So think average cost producer on this chart. There's a lot of variability here. Again, I have a purple line in the middle. That's at $150. I put that there to give context because of 2014 and what it did to this chart. Is before 2014, we looked at the years of 2004, 5, and almost 2013 as some of the best years. We almost hit $150 return over cash cost. In 2014, we estimate those returns were 525 or 528. 3 times better than what we used to call the best year, right? So part of the reason I asked you, did you make money like 2014, was if you didn't then, you had to have a serious discussion, or presumably you'd have a production hiccup, because this isn't real popular to say, but I'm not sure I will live to see another 2014. And I would encourage you to manage, presuming you won't see it again. If it does, it's a pleasant surprise, right? Because it's way out of whack from a historical profitability perspective for an average cost producer. But what do returns like that do to the cow-calf sector? What do people do if they make 3 times what they've ever made before? Somebody give me 3 things that happen. What do they spend money on? Pickups. It's good for your Ford dealer. Yep. They also probably pay more for heifers than they did the year before. And if they're smart, they took the wife to dinner more than they did the year before, right? So there's a long list of things they spend, right? If you have cash in your pocket, you tend to spend it. Now, I'm not going to say they spend every dollar, but there was a notable increase in half-ton trucks, ton trucks, whatever purchase. But also, we had a spike in replacement values, okay? Really, what I want to highlight on is we pulled the trigger to expand the herd. Now, there's other expenditures that we all recognize that occurred too, but it was very rational because in a competitive market, we're going to expand and try to get more quantity sold at those higher prices until we push those profits out. And we're in the midst of doing that in aggregate for the industry. 2015, we estimate returns were $300, which if I was to hide the bar for 2014 from you, everybody in this room would have said, man, that was a really good year. But there's also quite a few people that, rightly so, remember making a couple $100 more the year before, and they're mad they didn't make $500 again. So again, glass half full, glass half empty. Those 2 years combined are an aberration in terms of long-term profits in the cow-calf industry. But they are strong incentive to expand the herd. We've done it, and I suspect, my forecast is these returns, as we continue to add calves to the calf crop, we're putting supply-side pressure on markets. And unless we have really strong beef demand growth, which is possible, but it'll take really strong to offset that, We're going to pressure these profits down until we get well below the 150 mark, to where nobody wants to expand more, and we'll have to go a couple more years to actually push some cows back out of the system. That's what the cycles are over time, right? But it's important to keep in mind where we're at in that story. Okay? There's just a couple slides to kind of give you proof we pulled the trigger on expansion. This goes back to 1986 through 2016. It's the January cattle inventory report. USDA NAS puts this out every January and on most Julys, although sometimes that's sequestered. But it gives us some insight about how many heifers are being retained. What I want you to take from this was 2 years in a row, a huge increase in heifer retention. So 2015 versus 2014 and then 2016 versus 2015 were both large increases in the number of heifers retained. So economic signal was retained and aggregate did occur. But this actually understates the magnitude of expansion because this is just total number of heifers. So now, for those of you who have better memories than me, what did we do between 2010 and say 2013? What was going on here in South Oaks? Okay, what was one of the things we did during the drought? Right, the breeding herd got smaller, correct? So if we're retaining more and more heifers from a base of females that's getting smaller and smaller, the percent we're retaining is even higher than this chart suggests, right? And that's what this chart is. So I plotted heifer retention as a percent of the total beef cows in the herd. Because not only is it sufficient to say how many heifers are in the system, but if you really want to answer the question, how strong are we trying to expand, you need to put it on a relative basis, given how many cows we had, right, to give us heifers in the system to retain. And this gives you longer-term context of just how hard we are trying to expand. So going back to 1970, I plotted this. In 2015, 2016 are the two highest years since 1969 in terms of the percent of heifers we've held out of the female breeding stock. Normally, right, long-term average, that purple line, we hold back about 17% of heifers relative to beef cows in the system, right? So you guys see 16-18% numbers are kind of rules of thumb. The average over this period was 17.2. To give you some context, the last 2 years are really strong. 3% may not sound like a lot, but that's a lot of heifers given the fact we don't have a lot of cows in the system. So we are in the midst of a strong effort to expand. Downward pressure on prices if you don't get demand to go up to offset that. Okay. The other part of this, we can give a whole talk on cattle cycles, and I'm happy to take questions on this if you want, but this is a history lesson of when we start cattle cycles, increase inventories, and then when we decline them, we start the process over and over again, and these cycles go back to 1938, so there are kind of 9 completed cycles, and we've started the 10th one on this chart. You can see historically, most of these cycles go 8 to, the longest is 14, but most are 8 to 12 years. So it's about 8 or 12 years from when we pull the trigger to expand, when we get to the peak number of cows, and when the market shovels back out, and we start all over again, right? You go from trough to peak to trough, start over again. Those are the cattle cycles over time. I put a purple arrow here for where we're at on this blue line. We are very early from a historical perspective in this cycle. My anticipation is, if Mother Nature allows it, which is code for if it rains, right, because that's critical to facilitate expansion, that we will continue to expand for another 2 or 3 years, and maybe even faster than we have in the past. So the slope of this might be steeper than in the past, and then it'll stop. Because I think we're close to removing that incentive for the average cost producer, but as soon as we remove it, we almost always still expand for 1 or 2 more years, because we pulled the trigger on grooming heifers to be retained and so on and so forth. So we actually do it a little bit longer than the market says you should. That happens all the time. So my anticipation is we have a couple more years of building, a couple years of kind of flat, and then we will start to decline the number of females in the system. The only thing that will change that in my mind would be adverse weather would stop the expansion. I don't wish that on anybody, but we gotta be real, that's possible. A very positive global demand improvement could make the expansion go longer. A very adverse global economic environment could shrink it quicker. Right? Those are the main triggers you got to think through on this path, but in the absence of being able to forecast exactly, you know, China's economic environment, so on and so forth, I think you should presume we're going to continue to expand this for a couple more years. So that's my best overview for the cow-calf sector. I briefly want to transition to the stocker segment. I'm going to highlight a tool I encourage you to use. So there's a website here in the middle called beefbasis.com. Myself and others at K-State have worked with a group out of Wyoming to build this. Basically, what this website does is it pulls in feeder cattle futures market information every night, so it gets the closes from the board, couples it with a whole lot of basis information. I can detail that if you want, but I won't bore you. And because of that, you get cash price forecast, you get basis forecast as well. That's why we call it beef basis. for pretty much any weight class under 900 pounds. So it's a feeder cattle tool, it's under 900 pounds, for several markets around the country. And you can get it several months in advance if you want. I put two scenarios up here just to motivate the tool. And I'm using Salina prices here. Was, let's say you own a 700 pound animal, or sorry, you're looking to buy, which is the same as you own it. And you're looking at 422, April 22nd that is, and then you're entertaining, put another 50 pounds on it. Okay, that's what this hypothetical is. What this beef basis tool does is it kicks out the value of the animal at the lightweight, the projected value of the animal at the heavyweight, and it backs out what the value of those additional pounds are. Okay, so the value of gain in this exercise. At the moment, that particular scenario, putting another 50 pounds on, is worth 15 pounds for 100. You only put half those on, so it's worth $7.50 to do it. Nobody in this room, unless you're stealing pasture, corn, and labor, right, has cost of gain that low, right? So I'm giving you that as an example. The market is telling, if this fits your story, to not put those 50 pounds on, to send it to market. Okay? Cost of gain are higher than value gain in that story. Go further out here, so it's motivating the tool. Let's say you're entertaining buying in the middle of September a 555-pound calf, and you're going to have it until about Christmas that weighs 750. You can change the pounds, you can change the days, just to motivate it. All right, you get projected purchase, projected sale prices. At the moment, that scenario is projected to be worth about $65 per hundredweight, the value of gain. If your costs are below that and you are okay with the risk, that's something you should entertain doing. If your costs are north of $65, then that says you shouldn't entertain that stock or prospect. Okay? If you change the placement dates a little bit better, the projected value gains get better. That's all my note at the bottom. And that's mainly because the steepness in the feeder cattle market, John alluded to earlier, isn't as steep if I get out to the November contract. So what I buy gets cheaper, basically. If you don't buy them as early, then that trade-off isn't as bad. My motivation behind giving you all of this is if you are in the cow-calf business and you do some backgrounding, or if you're a commercial stocker, use this resource to get a market-based forecast of the value of gain for any scenario you're thinking about. And then compare it with your cost, and then make the decision. Does that make sense to everybody? Anytime somebody calls me, I literally walk through this on the other end. And I find the market that's in that tool that's closest to them, and do the same thing I'm doing with you right here. Okay? Everybody's costs vary, and you need to know that to compare against the value of gain. So let's talk feedlots for a moment. Most of you in the room probably know I attempt to monitor quote-unquote typical cash-to-cash-to-cash profitability in the feedlot industry. And what do I mean by cash-to-cash-to-cash? It sounds like lawyer speak. Is I put out a barometer every month using the Focus on Feedlot survey that comes from the Animal Science Department. So that gives me death loss, placement weight, outweight, those kind of production pieces. And I couple that with corn, feeder cattle, and live cattle price information to depict what a feedlot return in Kansas would have been, what's projected to be, if you pay cash for corn as you need it, cash for feeders, and you get basically the five market cash price per fit. If you implement price risk management on that, then my story doesn't fit you, okay? And it's important because I'm exaggerating variability return if you're mitigating that sum. But, right, if you have a cash-cash strategy, that's what I'm mimicking. So that's important to keep in mind here. Every month I update this. The most recently updated was on the 8th of April, and I'm going to share with you the projections for the feedlot industry. I guess before I give you the projections, I should remind you, for those of you that aren't in the feedlot sector, we're coming out of one of the worst periods. This exercise projects a $500 loss for animals sold in December. Literally, if you paid the going rate roughly 6 months before that for feeders and took the going rate for fed cattle in December and paid the going rate for corn in between, I estimate you would have lost $500 per steer. That's pretty extreme. The break-even cost of gain is actually negative in that story, which means somebody would have had to pay you to take corn for you to break even, which obviously doesn't happen. But to give you context, the reason that happened was a large drop in fed cattle price, right, after you locked in a high feeder cattle price earlier. That was the squeeze that occurred. That's just a recent history lesson, but it's important to keep in mind here. Going forward, I try to project basically for the next 9 months. There's a one-month lag in that Focus on Feedlot survey, so I'm always a month behind on the first row up here. But I'm projecting the closeouts in March were a loss of 189, and go out here to, say, I've got October in red, if you can see it, was a loss of $45. So how are those returns improving? Because yes, it's negative, but they are improving. The projections are to improve. It's not cost of gain, because we're still in this low $80 cost of gain per hundredweight projections. Fed cattle price isn't improving, but we beat up the feeder cattle market, right? So hopefully you guys can appreciate how all these things are connected. I started with notable decline in calf prices earlier. Over time, one of the reasons that's happening, of course, is feedlots are trying to pay less for feeders. If you have abnormally large losses, you try to, right, push down one of your main input prices, that's what's been going on. Looking out here to October specifically, that $45 loss is being projected. The break-even fed cattle price is just $3 above what I'm projecting from the board, and there's easily $3 movement in basis. So if you have a favorable basis compared to what I'm projecting, then it's a break-even basis they projected for October. So I'm a little bit hopeful that the worst is behind us for the feedlot industry, but please note I'm not projecting $300 gains. I'm just projecting maybe we don't have $300, $400, or $500 losses ahead of us. So improvement is good, but that's not the same as the best years we've ever had are ahead of us. Okay? Now, I want to wrap this up and take some questions. I told you I was going to end with demand. Demand is not consumption, right? And I sound like a broken record, but that's very important to appreciate. And I'm going to belabor that here for a moment. Everybody that is a livestock producer needs to understand that beef demand has been very good for the last 5 years. This chart goes back to 1990. So annually, as well as every quarter, I try to quantify beef demand. And what do I mean by beef demand? I do not mean beef consumption. I mean how much does the public value those beef pounds we're offering them. So over time, we vary how many beef pounds are being sold. And over time, the price, right, that clears the market at the retail level, varies. If that price is higher than I anticipated, given the pounds we put out there, then I say demand increased, because that means people paid more than I thought they would have. If that price is lower than I anticipated, I say demand declined, because they weren't willing to pay what I thought they would have given the pounds. Okay? Last 5 years in aggregate, they've paid more for retail beef than we thought they would, even after accounting for the fact we had fewer pounds in the system. That's important. And two simple examples of this. Most of you have seen scatter plots like this. Vertically, I've got retail beef prices, and then horizontally, I've got pounds per capita, so the amount of beef consumed per person. In red, I've highlighted 2008 versus 2009. Moving to the left is fewer pounds consumed, and moving down is a lower retail price. So when we went from 2008 to 2009, we actually sold fewer pounds, and we got a lower price. That can only happen if demand fell apart, right? We had a very bad demand story. Well, that was largely the recessions. And there's other things that went on, but if you remember, that was key in the middle of the U.S. recession. So that's a simple example of beef demand declining. If you have to drop the price of your product to move fewer pounds than you did last year, demand fell apart. The opposite happened when we went from 2011 to 2012. So 12 is slightly to the right, which means we had a little bit more consumed per person than we did in 2011. And it's above it, so we got a higher price. And these are inflation adjusted, so it's not, you know, because of that. If you get the public to consume more and pay you more, then demand improved. Everybody follow those two extremes? In reality, in most years, it's in between those two extremes. But those are good, just simple examples of what's been going on that we got to keep in mind. Now, while we have this chart up, I think it's important to keep in mind also, we had a lot of years here before 2008 that we were bouncing this mid-60s, trying to get towards 70 pounds consumed per person, and we kept bouncing around in the same price arena. We didn't have a lot of demand growth in that period. Okay? Moving to the left, we've been shrinking the amount of beef available per person. Again, lower calf crops while the U.S. population grows, while exports have grown in aggregate over that time, leads to less being consumed per person. We've been on this path, right? The real question going forward is, if instead of going to the left, we now start expanding production, which I'm trying to tell you adamantly, we've already pulled the trigger on, we're going to be doing that, then we're going to start coming back to the right with more pounds per person in the system. The question is going to be, how much downside price pressure on retail prices are going to be? Everybody following me? We've been doing this since 2008, moving to the left because, with the exception of 1 year, we've offered fewer pounds per person. As you expand, you start going back the other way. If the industry's fortunate, we won't come down. We'll rather go sideways and hold price, or really optimistically go up like we did in 2012. But that's what we have to watch. To give you specific numbers, the projections are almost 55 pounds per person will be consumed in 2016. And if we have just under a 1% decline in price, I will then be sitting here telling you that was exactly what was needed to clear the increase in pounds, that demand in 16 was just the same as it was in 2015. That will be the no demand change story. If we have those pounds and we got to drop the price by 5% to clear them, I'm going to tell you demand fell. And if optimistically price doesn't change, you move those pounds, demand went up. Okay? That's what I'm monitoring. For the first quarter, so we're working our way through 2016, I can tell you what happened. So this is the quarterly information year over year just for the first quarter. In the first quarter, we had about a 0.6% decline in demand. So negative is not good, right? But I want you to keep some context of what a year-over-year change means. The first quarter of 2015 was actually the best year we've had since 1992. 2015 first quarter was the strongest beef demand we had since 1992. So you got to keep in mind, 2015 was a really good demand year that we're comparing against. So this small decline I'm saying that happened in the first quarter is compared to a really good year. And I think it's important. I would actually score that as a kind of a win, because we pushed more, almost 4% more pounds through the system. And yes, prices had to come down to do it, but they didn't have to quote unquote tank to do it. We retained most of those demand gains that were realized in 2015. So for those of you following me, this small decline is actually a little bit of a win. You'd prefer a positive, of course, but the fact it didn't fall apart a lot, given we had a large increase the year before, is actually a pretty positive sign. Okay? So long-term beyond demand, where do I think we're going? I like to share these USDA 10-year projections to kind of give you long-term context. This is germane if you're thinking about expanding the herd. Those aren't single-year decisions and so forth. Last November, USDA updated these. They put them out for the next 10 years. Down at the bottom, you can see the punchline. They are projecting by the year 2025, we will have 14% more cows in the system than we had in 2014. That's a projection. Obviously, it won't hit it exactly. But the economics underneath it are abnormally high returns, pull the trigger on expansion, and we're going to do it. That's basically what's underneath that 10-year story. If that happens, it'll be the largest number of cows in our system since 2001. Now, somebody tell me how our address weights compare today with 2001.
Bigger.
Yeah, quite a bit bigger, right? So a lot more beef being produced than we did in 2001. So even if we have some number of cows, we're producing a lot more beef in the system, right? It's one of the reasons that they're not projecting more cows, because we frankly don't need as many cows to hit a given beef production target. Okay? The other thing that's important to appreciate, because I haven't talked much about exports, but I was planting the seed for questions, is over this same 10-year period, USDA is projecting what looks like a lot of export growth, but I'm going to tell you it needs to be even more. They are projecting, over those 10 years, a 53% increase in volume. That's total over the 10 years of what we export. That sounds like a big number, but I want you to keep some context. If you put that relative to the amount of beef we're producing in those 2 years, it's not a big change. So in 2015, we exported just over 9% of what we produced. If these numbers hold out to 2025, USDA is saying we'll then be exporting 12% of what we produce. So aggregate growth, small growth in a percentage of what we produce will be exported, but not a lot. And I want you to hone in on this 12% for a moment in your head. We have never broke this kind of artificial ceiling I have drawn up here. This is exports over time, and it's exports as a percent of what we produce, going back to 1992. Most here can remember the cattle skull Christmas in 2003, right? We lost Asia for 3 or 4 years after that, so we've worked our way back out of that. But what I want you to take from this chart is for a year, we've never hit 11% of production being exported. The U.S. beef industry is traditionally very, very reliant on U.S. consumers of their product. Going forward, and I'm very patriotic, so don't take it the wrong way, that has to change. If you're putting more pounds out in the system, and it's not just beef, right? Pork, poultry are doing the same. And most think income growth is going to be faster outside the U.S. than in it in different ways. Population growth certainly will be. We have to break that threshold. And we can talk a lot about that if you want. But if you want one thing in the next 10 years that I'm most concerned about, is if we don't break that and you have a lot more cattle in the system, that's a lot of downward price pressure throughout the entire system. So let's wrap this up and take any questions you have. Cow-calf returns here in 16, by historic standards, are still strong, right? They're still projected to be maybe $200 for an average cost producer. That's not nearly as good as 2014 or 15, but certainly in my eyes, strong enough not to stop expansion if it's raining. Stockers, I just give you two simple examples. The returns vary a lot, depending on exactly what scenario you're looking at. For those of you recently, you know, purchased 6 weeks ago and you're looking, market's been not nice to you, watch those margins. There's some signals that be positive for some scenarios, but there's a lot where the market's saying, no, do not put those pounds on. Let somebody else do it. Let's get to it cheaper. And for feedlots, I'm a little optimistic that the fourth quarter of 2015 was as bad as it's going to get, but I'm not optimistic that we're going to have a banner year ahead of us. So basically an ongoing struggle, but hopefully not as bad as we've had. You guys get this point. I think we're past the tipping point on supplies. The role of demand is going to become very clear. For those of you that I wet the whistle with that and you want more details, there's a fact sheet I've highlighted here. You can go read about that. more white man type shirt. I think that's critical to success going forward. And I'll end with this last comment. You should be doing this whether you're making money or not. But in a competitive business like the cattle industry, no matter what sector you're aligned with, long-term pressure is for an average cost producer to not make money. I mean, that's a cold economist, cold-hearted statement, I understand, but you got to appreciate it. So you have to know your comparative advantage and be better than somebody else has something. That could be better at running cows, so you're more efficient. That could be more efficient in the feed yard, so you have better average daily gain. It could be a lot of things, but you've got to know it. And when you move away from years like 2014, where you kind of just had to have a calf to sell and make money, you get back to quote-unquote normal price relationships, that's going to be very, very important to appreciate. Take to heart and implement. So with that, this is my last slide. Agmanager.info is the website for those of you who haven't been there. We have a contributors page, so there's a lot of fellow economists that have our names there. When you click on it, you'll get things like my mailing address and so forth. But most importantly, there's a link on there to all my presentations. So this presentation, which actually is already posted this morning, is there for those of you that want it. So with that, John, I'll take any questions we have.